Okay, this is take three of our interview with Bill Chandler. And you were talking about a parallel union within the union.
Yeah, Tony was actually, leading the Texas group in a different direction in that period. And there was an attempt by Gilbert to try to take care of it, but Caesar wouldn't, it was really something that Caesar should have done himself. And I had urged him on a number of occasions to intervene himself and get involved in one way or the other and either, get them back into the main focus or give them the authority or the blessing to continue what they were doing, and then we would work together. I was constantly getting conflicting directions from Caesar. One time he wanted to help, the other time he would say not to do anything. And I told him that you've got to deal with it, you've got to talk to him. But he wouldn't talk to Tony directly. He sent Gilbert and others to try to deal
with
it.
What do you think was going on with Caesar at that time that he didn't want to get involved?
I think it was more of a personal thing between him and Tony. Tony had always been critical of Caesar and Dolores, actually, from the very early days of the National Farm Workers Association.
Right, critical in what way?
Just different things. He didn't agree with, at first he didn't agree with the grape strike that started in the fall of 1965.
Mm-hmm.
He thought that there were smaller grape strikes that preceded that, and then the Rosa strike. And he was convinced that at that time that the union wasn't ready to take on the strike. And so he, in effect, stayed out of it until the winter, I guess close to the winter time of 1965. Then he got in and he went on the Schindler boycott to Chicago. But there are just different things that would happen. And then other problems with the administration of the union. He was treasurer of the union and felt he didn't have authority to do things that he thought he should be doing. And there was a conflict between him and Caesar about how money was spent and nothing illicit or anything, but just, what do we do with it? And of course, Tony was with us in the Rio Grande Valley the first time around and felt that the union and the AFL-CIO and other people should have done more for the Mellon strike than they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a lot of people's perception. And so there were just differences like that all the way through. And I guess the breaking point came, in 74 or 75 when a real strike started in the Rio Grande Valley with a lot of workers. And
how many are we talking when you say a lot?
Oh, a couple thousand. I mean, for that area, that's a bunch of people. And it was all over. It was all over in the row crops in the lower Rio Grande Valley, which is where the real work is done, as opposed to Starr County, where we were, 66 and 67. And so he felt the time had come, and a lot of people felt the time had come. But through the struggle that they were having, between Tony and Caesar and Gilbert and so on, that, things started floundering. And then they, I guess, decided to continue on their own, and they renamed themselves the Texas Farm Workers, and they adopted the red flag with the white background, and they put the tree as a symbol of...
Rather than the eagle.
And the tree was because we had 10 acres of land that had been donated by the Catholic Church to the UFW sometime before. And there was a huge oak tree on it. It was the only tree like that for miles around. And that was like, the symbol of the farm workers. And we had built a union hall there and, things like that. So workers in the valley knew where it was because of the tree, And so that's why they adopted that. Their symbol. And they had in 1978, they had a march to Washington. They had a march to Austin. And, they're attempting to do with very, very limited resources, the same sorts of organizing. It's like duplication of what we had done before.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were Mellon strikes in West Texas that they were involved in that were actually initiated by other workers that were not from the Rio Grande Valley, but were from Lubbock and that area there, and they attempted to win those strikes. And a lot of those were pretty violent. The law enforcement really came down on the organizers and the workers. And to this day, there's, a decent movement that's really focused on workers without a lot of support from outside of workers in West Texas that are organizing, both in and out of the Texas farm workers.
Have the two solved their problems?
No, I think the TFW kind of has melted away, but not entirely. I mean, there's still, I mean, people that were active in it are still active, but in West Texas. And the years that I was in the Rio Grande Valley with the Texas State Employees Union, there was very little visibility of any kind with the Texas farm workers. And then some of the key people that were involved in that went back to the UFW, Rebecca Harrington and Jim Harrington, and, you know, a core group of workers that have been there, you know, from day one. They, you know, reestablished the UFW and took back the Union Hall. The Union Hall actually was donated to UFW, not Texas farm workers, and there was a trial, and Texas farm workers lost, and the UFW got their hall back.
An election?
No, it was a lawsuit that was filed by the UFW to recover the property.
Oh, okay.
And the UFW won.
And how long were you in the union after that?
UFW? Oh, I left. I came back to California in the, I guess it was summer of 75, and I worked with Richard Chavez on the Rose campaign. And then in the fall, later on, I went to Calexico. Mm-hmm. And
can you describe the Rose campaign?
What we're doing is organizing a number of rose growers in the McFarland area. And the workers that work in the roses is very stable work. It's not like, you know, you work here for a couple months and go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
There's constant care that goes into producing roses and grafting them and then digging them up for sale and so on. So you have a very stable workforce.
How is the workforce treated? Are they treated differently than
the seasonal
workers?
Yeah, they're very much an elite group of farm workers. And there were a lot of them that were involved in the union from day one. In fact, they had their own strike in the spring of 1965 that was successful. It didn't really win contracts or anything, but it won improvements. And so there was always that core group of NFWA or then later UFW supporters among those workers.
Mm-hmm.
So we built on that core group as like an organizing committee, and we began putting together the union by, you know, getting authorization cards signed for the union representation election. Mm-hmm. And we had a number of elections and won. Richard and I and three or four other workers were working on that campaign, Rose workers. And then I went to Calexico, where a very intense campaign was going on with the lettuce. But at that point, I think for me, there were political things that I wasn't comfortable with in the union, plus personal things. And, you know, I was in California, and by that time I was, I guess, more committed to Texas too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to Texas. And I had wanted to take a break for a couple months and then see what I wanted to do. And a friend of mine who'd worked on the boycott was running for re-election for a state representative, and he was very progressive. And it was a fluke when he first got elected in 72. But they wanted me to work on his campaign and run his campaign, so I agreed to do that. And then a couple other state reps wanted me to work with them. So,
mm-hmm. So you started slowly working your way out of the farm workers part
of
it.
So I went to work to organize their re-election campaigns, and then I got sucked into the Carter campaign. And people were encouraging me to run for state representative too, but then I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, Nick and Virginia Jones had left, and others had left the UFW, and Nick was working for the Retail Wholesale Department Store Union, RWDSU,
mm-hmm.
and knew of the interest in 1199, which at that time was part of RWDSU, in organizing in the South. So in March of 76, I went to work with 1199. To organize healthcare in the South.
You're saying that you left the union and Nick and Virginia left the union.
They left after, I guess.
Was this a wholesale, maybe a wholesale, but division and finally just everything had reached a head?
It was probably, that happened, I guess. I left at the end of 1975. So I think it pretty much took place during the summer of 1976. They had, at that time, the boycott operation nationally was extremely effective. And they had literally hundreds of people that were involved with it on a full-time basis. And the boycott effort was able to raise enough money out in the cities to pay for itself, you know, twice over. And mm-hmm. Nick and Virginia were coordinating the boycott nationwide out of La Paz. And first, there was the proposition campaigns that surrounded the Agricultural Labor Relations Act, that Proposition 22 that was to take away the effectiveness of the act.
Mm-hmm.
Nick and Virginia were organizing, you know, that campaign in California, as was Marshall Gantz. And there was a conflict in early 76 between Marshall and Nick in Virginia. And I think it was manifested in by Caesar's paranoia and, you know, pushed through Marshall, and then, you know, there was a bitterness there between the two. They had a falling out, and I guess that Caesar, after the Proposition 22 campaign, Caesar fired Nick and Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically fired the whole boycott because there were people that, you know, would relate to Nick and Virginia. And just hundreds of people were driven out of the union all at once at the time, both workers who were perceived to have loyalties to them, and then, you know, organizers that had been recruited through the boycott from various other parts mm-hmm. of the country. And I wasn't there, but, you know, Nick and Virginia first told me about it. And then a couple of years later, as Eliseo Medina was driven out, he told me the real truth was, you know, what Nick and Virginia said. And then later, Marshall, when Marshall was driven out, he told me that he had played a very, you know, disgusting role, you know, with Nick and Virginia. And Gilbert, you know, same thing. But during that,
he was asked to do this?
They're asked to, you know, drive Nick and Virginia out.
What were the main reasons for it?
I think that they thought that Nick and Virginia were organizing a big communist movement or something. I think that's, mm-hmm. you know, the fear of the left and whatever agenda that meant to Caesar and people. And, you know, Gilbert was involved in it, and, you know, he admitted that it was, you know, a terrible mistake on his part, and Marshall did. All of them were involved at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in turn, were driven out, you know, through one way or the other. And you should get their stories from them.
Yeah.
And Chris Hartmeyer became a hatchet person, you know. Then eventually he was driven out. And I don't know the details of that, but I thought it was ironic that, you know, that happened to all these people who were doing...
What was changing with Caesar and at that time to make him view this as more paranoiac?
Well, there was an affection with Synanon, you know, that developed, and their techniques of, I guess, tearing people down and reconstructing them through some sort of therapy that they did. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that Gilbert and I have always been friends in and out of differences that we may have had with the UFW. And during the period when they were doing these Synanon kinds of things in La Paz, where they would tear people down and cuss them out, and I just, you know, try to destroy them and then rebuild them in another way. You know, he was telling me at first that it was great, and, you know, and then pretty soon, you know, when I would talk to him off and on, he was getting more and more disillusioned with it. Eliseo, who was, you know, he's really one of the best organizers in the country and, you know, operates on solid common sense. When he refused to participate in those things, he went up and watched one once and was just shocked at whatever they were called. I can't think of the name of them. Sort of encounter sessions. But they had a name for the things. I don't know what they are. That he refused to participate in. At that point, then, when Eliseo refused to participate, then Caesar put him on the list, you know, and started driving him out. You know, when people refused to participate in that stuff, they were driven out. And Gilbert got to the point where, you know, it was ridiculous. And Marshall and so on, and Jessica and others.
And you were out by
this
time?
I was gone by then. I missed all the horrible stuff that went on. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it still goes on. I certainly hope that it doesn't. But all these things, you know, regardless, to me, you know, that's struggle, you know, to win the contracts, to win whatever went, you know, that, you know, took precedent over the internal stuff that was going on. And mm-hmm. it didn't stop Norma and myself from getting involved. We set up a boycott committee in Atlanta and then later in Birmingham and other places, you know, mm-hmm. as best we could in between organizing healthcare workers or whatever, you know, we were doing.
Mm-hmm. So you're still trying to take active role with the farm workers?
I think, you know, the struggle is more important than the internal stuff that goes on mm-hmm. in any union. And if I'm part of the internal thing, I try to support the progressive side of it. Mm-hmm. But if I'm not part of it, their struggle still has validity and should be supported.
Still keeping your touches with the union, how do you evaluate it today as compared to when you first got involved in it? Mm-hmm. What are the differences or similarities? What are the goals? Are they the same or different?
Well, in those days, it was a different time, and we were all much younger than we are now, and and naive. And it was a credit that we were in. We had no real preconceptions about how things were supposed to be. There was no real formula, you know, and I think everybody got in and did the work, whatever it is that we decided to do, and, you know, and worked very hard on it. And we tried things that might not have worked. We tried things that did work, and so on. We weren't forced into a mold, you know, that, well, that doesn't work, I know, because, you know, something mm-hmm. happened in my life. And, you know, everybody was new at it. In fact, really, Caesar was, too, in the start. He was a good organizer and some of the basic stuff, but actually taking on in a massive confrontation like this, it was new for everybody. And I think people in those times had broader and bigger visions. There were all kinds of visions that people had about how they thought things should be. But they're willing to come together and work. I think the best thing about the UFW, at least in its first 5 years, and if not longer, was that it was inclusive. We tried to get as many people involved, regardless of if they were workers, supporters, or whatever, and there was a real movement because we reached out and we included people, and people felt part of something that was good, you know, that was building. And a very large number of people developed and went off and did other things that were maybe more to their self-interest, whether it was political organizing in Texas or California, or going back to a union they may have come out with. In effect, I went back to the world that I was used, you know, that I came out of, which was, you know, public hospitals. Mm-hmm. And I began organizing hospital workers and using the things, you know, that many, building on the experiences that I had with the USW. And a lot of other people have gone back to their worlds and taken that kind of organizing, you know, with them. And there's significant changes going on in the labor movement as a result of that. Teamsters for Democratic Union, a lot of the people that are involved in that were involved in the boycott in Detroit and other places. And, mm-hmm. you know, and they were Teamsters, you know. So it had an effect all over, you know.
And so you do believe the philosophy of the farm workers has gone beyond the farm worker himself?
Oh, absolutely. But I think the philosophy, people talk about nonviolence and all that. I think that's more of a, I don't think that that's particularly the reality of organizing, but what it is getting workers involved and getting them to take lead and mobilizing and doing things and understanding, you know, the vision and then the short-term goals and trying to accomplish that. Just like Jorge was talking about in his first meeting with the supervisors, you know, or whoever the organizer was, you're from here, you do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just getting people involved and in taking the lead and struggling to change their lives. You know, like that is more important than anything else. The union movement up to that time had been representational. In other words, people were elected to represent you at negotiations or represent you. So you might sit back as a worker passively watching your union rep or business agent or whatever do something. It was a business thing. The UFW brought struggle in a big way back into the labor movement. Mm-hmm. And I think it's helped prepare a lot of, you know, and it's dovetailed with other movements, with 1199, which was always into struggle, or another union where hundreds of organizers came out that went on to other unions and so on. Another, you know, it was another movement that was special, like the UFW. So, you know, those kinds of things, you know, I think were important. More, you know, we can debate a nonviolence versus violence, I don't think it means a lot in terms of the practical realities of struggle.
Mm-hmm. And the UFW today?
I think that I have a lot of respect for Arturo Rodriguez, the new president. He's young, and I think he's a very creative person. I knew him when he was in school, and I think he's, you know, I think that he'll do the organizing work that's necessary to really rebuild, to make it into, you know, a real movement of workers. And I think that he'll do that. It'll be different because the times are different, conditions are different, and what you need to do to win will be different. You know.
What do you think they need to do to win?
I think they need to get. I think they need to become a national movement again, in some form. They're using the boycott now, but I went to a Mississippi AFL-CIO meeting, and they had grapes all over the place. You know, it just has not penetrated nationally. There's not the consciousness that there was in the 70s, because they don't have the organization. They need to rebuild a boycott in a national way.
Mm-hmm.
They need also, I think, to now spread out to other states, as I think they're starting to do. With they got the group in Washington to affiliate with them, off and on the Farm Labor Organizing Committee in Ohio, which has been very effective in dealing with, you know, tomato growers and stuff, has been involved with the UFW. But I think that they need to see themselves as a national movement of workers. And
Flora Citrus?
They have like a remote control kind of a struggle going on with Coca-Cola, and they did get a contract there and so on. But I think, you know, I mean, the union has to see itself not in terms of, you know, here and there's something, but California is where it's at. But they've got to, you know, fight for the same kind of priorities for workers in other states.
So the Coca-Cola thing was more just an instant thing? I mean, it solved one problem, but not really.
Well, the Coca-Cola boycott didn't begin with workers organizing and saying we want our contract.
Mm-hmm.
It was really renegotiating or getting, you know, a new contract that had been expired for a year or two back in place. So there'd be some sense. And this is good. You know, Artie, I think, is doing right on that. But we've got to, you know, it's got to be a national union. It's got to be seen as that both externally and internally, as a national movement and something that people can be part of, you know, first workers and then people who care about workers. You know.
What would you tell young people like here at Cal State Northridge or even high school students just leaving high school trying to find themselves? Why should they get involved in supporting a farm worker who they've never seen?
Well, one, it helps that worker, but the other thing, it helps that young person develop and become focused on really what life is all about. You know, it's a myth in this society that you can, you know, do better than somebody else and succeed. And, it, you know, when you have a shop of, you know, 100 workers and you have 3 or 4 positions for management, you know, who's going to be there? You know, I mean, you're not going to spend your life trying to get, you know, get into a position that you have a 5% chance of getting into. What you've got to do is to bring everybody up together and to realize that, you know, the struggle in life isn't, you know, because there's something wrong with you. It's because there's something wrong with society, and we've got to join together and solve the problems together. And I think by helping other workers, just like we all did, we learned how to help ourselves, you know, as a group.
Do you spend much time on college campuses or going down to the community to let them know your visions of organizing?
Yeah, we're constantly invited to university classrooms. We have membership at Jackson State and the other universities there, so quite naturally we're invited to classes to talk about, you know, myself and the other organizers who are state workers there in Mississippi. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We do the same thing. I'm on TV and Brenda's on TV, and, you know, we're on talk show.
Brenda who?
Brenda Scott, who's president of our union.
Mm-hmm.
State employees. So we're constantly reaching out to people. Churches. We'll go and talk at churches on Sundays.
Do you see the farm workers starting to do that again, or today? The United Farm Workers?
I don't. Where I'm at in the South, I don't see that happening.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're doing that. In talking to Richard, that's what they're doing here in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, they've got to get a national focus if they're going to win, and, you know, build a permanent nationalization. It's just like the rest of the labor movement. We can't be isolated in one state or one country if we're going to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just like the corporations, we've got to become global and work together with unions in other countries. And UFW really has to build a national base. And agribusiness, as you know, is now multinational. Same growers that are here in Mexico or wherever, you know, with their pesticides. And, you know,
the issues are still there. And
but it's international. And,
right.
And the UFW, I think, really needs to set a goal of becoming part of that international organizing network that's beginning to develop between unions. And hopefully we'll get rid of Lane Kirkland and that'll, you know,
yeah,
happen. And Tom mm-hmm. Donahue. They're, you know, they're not going to, they're so scared of commies, you know, that they don't want to link with other unions. We have the weakest labor movement in the industrial world, maybe now next to the Soviet Union, but, or Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's terrible. And,
have you brought these issues up to Arturo?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen him. I haven't seen him since he left Texas, actually.
Mm-hmm. Is there, I'm trying to, how do I say this? Is there a movement to, well, you can't come in and tell them how to do it, but suggest to get this international scope?
Well, it's like with the poster show. I think, you know, the poster show is very important. And in 1199, what we did, we had a Bread and Roses program, and we had a poster show that was centered around healthcare workers that was taken all over the country. We used it as an organizing tool, and that we concentrated on the on galleries that were in cities where their organizing mm-hmm. campaign was going on, and built events around that. You know, that's a tiny thing, but it's something that they could do nationally. It would take some effort, but it might help rebuild consciousness for farm workers. You know. People see the posters from the struggles over the years that are on there. That's a little thing, but there's just, you know, I suggested that to Dolores, and she knows the same people I do that could make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Looking at it now, somewhat now, 30 years of organizing work, would you have ever changed any of this?
No, I think the thing that I think people...
Of your own life?
No, I don't think so. I think that... one thing that I've learned, particularly since I left the UFW, is that workers in this country, regardless of where they're at, suffer the same indignities. I mean, there's, you know, you go into areas in the South where people are working in chicken processing plants or catfish processing plants. It's no different than the crap that workers take in the fields in California,
mm-hmm.
or some of the clothing manufacturing factories. Or in healthcare, where they're severely understaffed, and you have nursing assistants doing the work that LPNs or RNs should be doing because the hospitals are too cheap to hire enough people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all over the country, in this country, workers are suffering the same indignities and shit, you know, that farm workers do. And a lot of these workers are homeless, too. I mean,
yeah.
Some people that, you have homeless rural people, you know, that are, you know, I guess for urban media, it's easier to make a big production out of farm workers and make people feel sorry for people who are somewhere else than people that are in their midst, you know.
Right.
And the people that are in the midst have the same problems that people in the fields do. And it's not like farm workers are worse than anybody, but they represent what's going on with everybody else in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that workers are workers and they have needs.
Well, sometimes I see, on my view, that it's easier for us to go look at what's going on in Somalia and try and fund programs there than it is to look down on 5th and Broadway in downtown Los Angeles.
All right.
And change our... It's too close to us. We hide from it. We avoid it. And so we go and do food drives for someplace in Somalia or something like that, rather than looking at.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a group that we participate in as a union called the Human Services Coalition in Mississippi, and it's made up of about 50 organizations, mostly church groups, that are involved in helping the poor.
Mm-hmm.
But when I first met with them, the poor were different than workers, you know, and unions and so on, and they couldn't see the connection between somebody that's making a minimum wage, you know, and no health benefits, and somebody that's on AFDC that they're concerned about. And it's very, I mean, the link there is very close in reality, because that person that's on that makes minimum wage tomorrow could be on AFTC. And they're going to help the person on AFTC, but the person that's got a job at $4.35 an hour, it's something different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they've been able to now, you know, understand that the woman that's on AFTC is a worker, just like anybody else. The worker that is making $4.25 an hour is just as poor with the same kinds of health needs and so on as the person on AFTC. And they understand it better now. In the early years of the UFW, we had a lot of support from churches who were very happy to get involved with supporting migrant workers. But when it came to urban workers organizing in a plastic factory, you know, oh, that's those unions. You know? And it was different. But the plastic factory worker were making the same as the farm worker.
Under the same conditions.
Yeah.
It's similar, anyway.
But that, you know, the role of the boycott also, you know, that whole organization linked those two. In many, many respects, you had church people in Chicago, you know, marching on picket lines with union activists from different locals, and they talked and they...
Mm-hmm. Can we have the successes of boycotts like we did in the 60s and early 70s today?
When people around,
can we still make spontaneous...
The greatest myth I've heard, I've been organizing in the South 20 years now, and everybody mm-hmm. says, well, it's hard there, and people don't join unions, and people are scared. And frankly, I organized in New York City off and on when I was with Live 99. Not for a very long time. I've organized in Chicago and California. The worst experience I ever had with workers was in California. We're trying to organize the mental hospitals, and I was in Atascadero. The worst workers I've ever run across in my life are in California. The state is supposed to be easy to organize in.
Mm-hmm.
The best groups that I've ever had are like in South Carolina or now in Mississippi, you know, people that really got into the struggle and made, you know, part of it. I think you can organize anywhere, you know. And I think all these things is that, you know, the South or whatever, it's not true. People are willing to struggle if they have the correct information, they have goals, they have, you know, they can agree on a vision that mm-hmm. they want to, and they'll do it, you know.
If you can show them what that vision is.
Right. And I would think of, you know, some years ago, it's amazing to me, you know, when I left in 1970, when I went from Chicago and I ended up in Texas. I spent some time in California, maybe about a month before I went to Texas. And I went to a fundraising party, and they were having a fundraiser for some young group of people from Nicaragua, and they're called Sandinistas, and I bought a poster, and it didn't connect with me, you know. But, you know, they went and built a movement there, you know,
mm-hmm.
and very quickly, or it seemed very quickly to me, and they won, at least until, you know, might of the United States got involved and screwed them all up. But, you know, the conditions in those countries are terrible compared to here, but they do it, you know. The hospital workers, you know, started that, as a matter of fact. It's 1108. Carmen's going to be here.
Okay, I don't want you to miss your plane.
No, I found out it's a little bit later than I
thought
it was.
I'm not sure I have any other questions for you, except that I'd like you to sort of reflect a little bit on some of the personalities that you've met in the union, Caesar,
mm-hmm.
How you see him and other, Dolores, mm-hmm. and a few of the other leaders,
mm-hmm.
how they've inspired you, how they've helped you maintain this strong feeling you have mm-hmm. for the union. You haven't given up on your philosophies at all since you were... Mm-hmm. practically, what, 18, 19, and, mm-hmm. and you seem to be getting stronger and stronger in it.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about them?
I think, you know, there's no one person that really,
mm-hmm.
and there's a combination of people that, you know, meant a lot in my life. First was, I guess the very first, well, first, of course, was Martin Luther King. I mean, he's just, you know, in the 50s, Rosa Parks, you know, all of that, mm-hmm. you know, had a big impact. I mean, the fact that they stood up, you know, and they're standing up in the face of tremendous oppression. You know. And then Blanche Session, who led the union at the LA County Hospital, she's just full of energy and You know, to mm-hmm. her dying day, she was always all over the place with workers and getting people involved and doing whatever needed to be done. And then Caesar, of course, you know, he's a very good organizer. Very, you know, when he was organizing, he was very good and was very supportive of what people were doing. And Dolores, I think, because she was extremely persistent and never went to sleep, you know, in those days, you know, when the mm-hmm. code was terminal and stuff. I think, you know, Caesar changed after the fast. I'm not sure it was the best thing in the world, but it served its purpose, I guess.
And you hung around with Gil Padilla an awful lot.
Yeah, Gilbert and I were very close. And when the first part of his life, he was an alcoholic, but he was a very good organizer mm-hmm. and was a fighter, and I admire that. He was more of a street fighter, I guess, in the UFW than Tony. Tony was more of an intellectual, and Dolores, of course, too. Caesar was a very practical organizer. I think we also developed bonds with other people that we worked with, and we influenced each other. Alcea and mm-hmm. I always, you know, we started at the same time and did stuff together, you know, with Gilbert or with other people, Dolores and so on over the years, and Nick and Virginia. You know, we all kind of reinforced each other as we went along, and that's the way it is now in organizing. We're helping each other out in ways, you know, that I run other organizers I'm around,
right.
What I'm doing now. We reinforce each other, and you don't worship somebody, but you draw on their experiences, mm-hmm. their guidance. Fred Ross, I think, had a big impact on me. I spent time with him, too, during the voter registration drives, and mm-hmm. He was a big influence.
And
Leon Davis and the hospital workers, you know, it's amazing to me that his best organizing was done after he was 50. And he mm-hmm. continued organizing until he was almost 80. You know. It was amazing.
And the rank and file workers themselves?
Oh, that's the best part of it. It's the workers. And the best campaigns I've been in, one are the farm workers, because so many workers were, you know, involved in a struggle. They didn't know what they're going to end up being, but they had a vision. You know, a lot of workers mm-hmm. had visions. You know, maybe they gathered from being in Mexico or the Philippines and the struggles that went on in those countries, and it helped define what they thought things should be. Or later with black workers in South Carolina or Alabama or wherever, who had other visions too, and were prepared to struggle. And when they were doing that, they would do the work, they would win. We won the first voluntary hospital that was ever organized in the South, was in South Carolina. We had a big campaign at a nursing home in Beaumont, Texas. It had 300 workers in it. And they were tough, and they won. It was the first nursing home in Texas ever to organize. You know, things like that were wonderful. And workers get together, you know, stand up, they can win.
Some people say, or would say, that when the central headquarters of the UFW moved to La Paz, that they were forgetting the farm worker, the rank and file. Do you see that? Do you agree with that statement? Disagree, or how?
I think
how do you
they
see
isolated
that?
Themselves. I don't think it was intentional. I think Jerry Brown offered them this thing for a dollar. Wow, you know, all these buildings mm-hmm. and, you know, up in the mountains, it's real pretty up there. You know, whatever. I think initially that was kind of the effect. I don't think there was any intention of becoming isolated from workers. Mm-hmm. But the effect of moving everything up there away from Delano, it did isolate people. And it created a culture of its own away from, you know, the real movement of the UFW. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a mistake. I think they should have recognized that and gotten out of it and gotten back to the 40 acres or someplace where there was constant contact with workers.
Have you been back to 40 acres?
Not in a good while. I went back there to visit people some years ago, you know, in Ogbayani Village. But it's a nice village. You know, they have mm-hmm. a building there that was a hiring hall. I don't think it's working as a hiring hall now. I don't know what's going on there now. Mm-hmm. But once, as organizers, if you remove yourself from the people you're organizing, you lose touch with them. And it's just like we're critical of the FLCO types that camp out in motels, and we call them motel jockeys. You know, they'll just Mm-hmm. Stay there looking at TV and hope that workers don't come knocking on their door, you know. They'll do home visits and come back and stuff like that, but it's, you can't organize like that. You've got to be available to workers and be constantly spending time with them. And when you're up on the mountain, you know, who's going to talk to you?
Do you think the leadership can come down from La Paz?
I hope that they, you know, the people that are in the leadership now recognize their isolation,
mm-hmm.
and do that. I think the possibility of that is pretty slim because it's a comfortable place now.
Maybe we are.
It's like being in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. But, you know. Well, you know, I see that. Yeah, when mentioning Washington, D.C., you can see our congressmen who were liberal for 10 years all of a sudden get caught up in the system, I think, sometimes.
Well, you know, also with the unions, I guess when they decided that the National Labor Relations Act and all that was important and they wanted to protect it, most of the unions moved their national headquarters into D.C. The railroad workers used to be in Indiana, then they moved to D.C.
Mm-hmm.
But the furniture workers moved out of D.C. back to the Deep South where their base was. The oil workers moved out of D.C. to Denver where their base is. Mine workers have moved out of D.C. and so on. And I think they recognize where they need to be is where the workers are. I mean, a union is simply an instrument of struggle for workers. It's nothing else. And if you remove yourself from workers, you know, what are you doing?
Very good. I think we should end it right here. No, that's a really good ending, mm-hmm. with it, because I do believe that without the workers, we're not in our business to be unions.
You have to start with them first.
Yeah. Unless you have any other, one other insight or highlight of your work with the farm workers that you'd like to share with us?
I can't think of anything now.
I think we've covered just about everything, and hopefully, as you said, we'll get around to interviewing the other people that will clear up some of the other issues that you weren't around for.
Mm-hmm.
I thank you very much for doing this.
Okay.
It's been a real honor to meet you.
All right.
And I hope we see you again.
Yeah, well, I've enjoyed being here. This is,
I hope you've enjoyed the exhibits and the meeting of old friends again.
Now, I was wondering if you have the collection of the hearings, the testimony, that the Senate Subcommittee on Migratory Labor did over the years. There's some very good stuff in all those books.
We might have some of that stuff in the Max Mott papers.
Yeah, he might have.
The original hearings.
Mm-hmm.
We have the reports.
Through the 60s and into the 70s, the hearings were very comprehensive, and a lot of the, all the different struggles that the UFW was in is recorded in those hearings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gilbert and Dolores and Caesar and Lariat Leong and other people always went to testify, and they take volumes of stuff with them, you know, to
mm-hmm.
be part of the record.
We don't have them here on this campus, but I'm quite sure that...
That might be a source that...
Actually, we could probably go look and see where those records are.
Yeah.
It'll be a good search.
I have a thing that we made in Texas when the senators were coming that, as far as I know, it's the only copy in existence. I could mail it to you, and you could reproduce it and...
Certainly.
Send it back to me or something.
Certainly would love
the
that.
Book about that thick of
okay.
stuff. You know,
that's good. You know, here, with the farm workers' papers being in Detroit, generally, I mean, as the, quote, official repository, we keep struggling to grab the history of the movement mm-hmm. here.
Yeah, my question is if they're still sending stuff over there, you know, from La Paz. I don't know.
For
a while, we all did it. And
when I was in Detroit in December looking through the collection, to prepare for all of this,
mm-hmm.
They said that they were boxing up 300 cubic feet in in La Paz, that they were supposed to, the archivist, one of the archivists there was going to go fly out there
uh-huh.
and pick those records up. So yeah, they're still sending it.
Yeah. They're microfilming all that stuff, I guess. Huh? Or they
no,
just
not
stash
yet.
It somewhere?
Right now they're just stashing it. They're organizing, but I mean, you know, it takes a long time to do the conservation work on a lot of this stuff. I remember when I was there, some of the records were coming in with potato chips in them.
Oh, I can imagine. You know, we had a box in the corner of the office, and we just, instead of throwing it in the trash, we'd throw it in the box.
I think Caesar kept
when
a few in his
up
truck, too.
He'd
keep some of his records in his truck, too,
yeah.
as he was moving around.
Yeah.
I hope that'll work, though.